Good morning. My name is John Jeffries. I am the dean of the law school, and for that reason, I think I have the privilege of welcoming you to this event. The Conference on Public Service and the Law is a major event in the life of the law school. It now has had several years iteration, and it continues to be the most elaborate and, in most respects, the most influential and meaningful of the events that we hold in the law school during the year. The point I most want to make about it is that it is an event conceived, organized, and run by students. It is not a law school event in the sense of an administrative assignment from my office or a faculty program. It is rather an expression of the sensibility of the community from the students up. And as every teacher will tell you, a school is defined in its culture and in its mission primarily by the interest and commitments of its students. I think the Public Service of the Law Conference says volumes about the interest and the commitments of our students, and that everything it says is good. A lot of people are involved in this program, and if I name a few, Nicole Flatto, Natalie Balzer, Jessica DeVere is the panel director, Liz Carter, the workshop director. They deserve special credit, yet I'm aware of sliding others who have also been participants. Before I sit down, I want to make just a word about what passes for the long view of history. The speaker today, who will be introduced in just a second, is Mary Bauer, class of 1990. Mary was the first Skadden Fellow from Virginia, and I believe that that was only the second year of the Skadden Fellow program. In the decade after Mary was a Skadden Fellow, we had some successors, but I think our record as a school in that competition, you all know what the Skadden Fellowship is. It's the most well-funded and prestigious postgraduate public service fellowship in the country. They have tremendously qualified people who apply for it. Skadden devised an extraordinarily successful mechanism for identifying people, and most of the burden of having of producing a Skadden plan falls on the applicant. That is, the applicant has to go and find the public service agency that will employ him or her, has to go and find what the duties will be, has to secure from the people who run that public service entity a commitment to house the person's project and to participate and approve it and so forth. So the application is not like filling out an application to go to law school. The application is itself a major project, and by the time the Skadden folks are selecting among these applicants, they really have a tremendously informative set of applications that show not only the talents of the individuals who've applied, but also their dedication and their skill and their commitment, their seriousness of purpose. In the decade or so after Mary Bauer led off for Virginia, we had, I think, spotty representation among Skadden Fellows. That was not due to a lack of commitment or interest among our students. It may have been due in some part to a lack of vibrant institutional support for their applications, but I honestly think the major factor was a kind of stereotype. Skadden Fellowships were run out of New York City. They thought that the University of Virginia Law School was a corporate, southern, conservative place, and that we just weren't as interested in public service, just not as committed to public service, not as engaged by the questions of social justice and economic justice as other schools. I'm glad to say that that misconception has been dispelled. Dispelled, I think, by a lot of student actions, including most prominently this conference annually. But dispelled is also by the success of our students when the Skadden Fellowships were given to Virginia students. In every case, they were delighted and impressed and inspired by their performance. And so one student, Mary was the beginning person, paved the way for the next and created an expectation that Virginia students should be considered along with those in the other great law schools in the United States, and this reputation of disinterest began to fade. This year, I am glad to say there are three Skadden Fellows from the University of Virginia. Dania Davy will be going to the Land Loss Prevention Project operating out of Durham, North Carolina. Mike Hollander will be with Community Legal Services in Philadelphia. And Matt Van Wormer will be with People's Legal Services in the Navajo Nation in Arizona. We also have the Powell Fellowship, which is a dedicated position for graduates of this law school. This didn't exist in 1990, but has now for about 6 years awarded a fellowship that looks in its structure rather like a Skadden. And we're proud to have Amy Willard awarded the Powell Fellowship this year. She'll be working with the Legal Aid Justice Center's Just Children Project in Richmond and in Petersburg. And Carrie Brege will have an Equal Justice Works Fellowship, working with Advocates for Children Services, a statewide organization in North Carolina. That's a lot of distinction and achievement in the graduating class of 2008. And it represents in public recognition the extraordinary traditions and commitments that people in this room and other students in this institution have produced. And I'll say on behalf of the faculty that we couldn't be prouder of you and what you've done, and couldn't be more pleased that the world at large has begun to recognize and appreciate public service at Virginia. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much, Dean Jeffries. Thank you all for coming this morning. I know you're all very busy, so I would just like to say on behalf of myself and Nicole and the entire conference board that we're so thrilled that you all could join us today. For those of you that were with us yesterday and last night, I apologize if I repeat myself a little bit. But I'd just like to say a few words about the conference and what it means to us in this law school, in addition to what Dean Jeffries said. We are in our ninth year of being one of the largest student-run public service conferences in the nation. About 60 students have been working on this conference for the past 6 months. And we, of course, have gotten overwhelming support from our faculty and our deans, so we thank them very much for that. Just very briefly, I'd like everyone to know what's gone on so far this weekend and what's coming up for the rest of the day. Yesterday afternoon, we kicked off with two outstanding panels. If you weren't there, one was on the regulation of greenhouse gases since the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts v. EPA, and the other was about violence against Native American women and the problems of tribal jurisdiction and the problems that the prosecution faces with those cases. Last night here in the pavilion, we heard from two extraordinary speakers, one none other than Mr. Mortimer Kaplan himself, who called on all of us to devote our lives, as he has, to the greater good, and also from New Jersey Attorney General Ann Milgram, who told us to follow our hearts to find a career that will make us happy. And if you missed Ms. Milgram last night, she is speaking again at 1 o'clock in one of our workshops, and I would highly recommend going to hear her speak. This morning we hosted three more extraordinary panels. I wish I could have gone to them all. One on prosecutorial discretion, one on conflict-driven migration in Iraq, and one on the reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind Act. And for 9:45 on a Saturday morning, I personally, and I know Nicole was too, thrilled to see how many people came out for those. So thank you for those of you that participated and came to hear those panels. For the rest of the day, after our keynote, we have workshops at 1 p.m. Where we'll be serving lunch, and we have a final round of panels at 2:30. I could not even begin to describe all of the options that are available to you, so please look in your programs, and at 4 o'clock we will have a closing reception in the Withers Brown Lounge. So if you're here, come by. Before I turn it over to Nicole, who will be introducing our keynote, I would just like everyone to keep in mind the theme of our conference this year, which is Fight for Justice. This theme has run through all of the panels we've seen so far, whether it's advocating for the rights of internally displaced persons in Iraq, looking for ways to prosecute the sexual violence against women on tribal lands, lobbying for the children here in our own education system. It can be overwhelming sometimes to think of how many injustices are occurring all around us. Terrifying, actually. But that's why this conference is such an incredible opportunity for us as law students. We see people who were just like us not long ago, studying the law here or elsewhere. And they have devoted their careers to correcting those injustices. The fact that all of our guests this weekend have dedicated their lives to public service is truly the greatest inspiration we could ask for, and it is what makes it such an honor to be part of this conference. Once again, I would like to thank all of our student organizers, our faculty, our deans, and all of the panelists and speakers who came in this weekend to unite with us in this common goal of fighting for justice. It has been an incredible experience so far, and I know that it will only continue throughout the day. So thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you, Natalie. I just want to extend a special thank you to Dean Jeffries, especially. We thanked him last night, but you weren't here to hear it. So he really went above and beyond the call of duty in helping us to address some particular sticky situations that we had this year. So thank you again. And thank you also again to our entire board, who really has continued to impress me and their creativity, the things that they've added to this conference, and the ways that they've made our lives easier. So thank you. I hope most of you have heard by now, but for those of you that haven't, our scheduled keynote, J. Richard Cohen, came down with a very severe case of the flu and was unable to make it today. He sends his sincerest apologies for having to cancel, but we are eternally grateful to her colleague, Mary Bauer, who offered to speak in his place. As you might understand, it's a lot of work to put together this scope of presentation at the last minute, so we really appreciate it, and I know she has an excellent presentation planned also on the Southern Poverty Law Center, so all of you who came to hear about that will not be disappointed. Ms. Bauer heads the Southern Poverty Law Center's newest and most dynamic initiative, the Immigrant Justice Project. She leads her staff in representing those who have no other champions, recent immigrants and migrant laborers. In addition to filing numerous complex lawsuits against corporate giants, the project has issued national reports that have changed the terms of the national debate over guest workers. As Dean Jeffries said, we think it is very apropos that Ms. Bauer has ended up as the keynote speaker this year because she was UVA's very first SCAN fellow, and I just wanted to add that I don't think it's an overstatement to say that it all started with Mary Bauer, in a sense. Tim Freilich, who was a later SCAN fellow, told me some stories about her, which I want to relate to you now. He was actually the second SCAN fellow, I believe. And he explained to me that when Mary first began, she started the immigration advocacy program here at Charlottesville's Legal Aid Justice Center, which is a really thriving and nationally known program now, as is all of the Legal Aid Justice Center. And she was so successful in suing farm worker and guest workers employees for unpaid wages and bad housing conditions that a coalition of growers associations and the Farm Bureau got a bill introduced in the General Assembly with the specific goal of taking away all of Mary's state funding. The bill, which informally became known as the Mary Bauer Bill, would have defunded all of Virginia's legal aid programs statewide and was used to bully the Legal Services Corporation of Virginia to stop funding Mary's work. So the state funding stopped for Mary as a result, but Mary did not. Instead, 10 years after having been awarded UVA's first SCADM Fellowship, she sponsored the second SCADM Fellow, Tim Freilich, who actually joked that the fellowship was hers and not his, for the strong ties that she had to the program, although Tim is a fabulous guy, so I'm sure he was very deserving as well. and thank you for these stories, Tim. Mary has gone on to do tremendous similar work at the national level, as part of the Southern Poverty Law Center, starting yet another immigrant justice project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, which didn't exist prior to Mary. The Southern Poverty Law Center is a renowned organization that has been known throughout its history for fighting hate and intolerance, so this is just the most recent problem. And I'm sure she'll tell you more about that later today, so I'd just like to end with one more anecdote from Tim, which I think speaks to the impact of Mary's cases. One woman who had worked shelling crabs in Virginia greeted Mary with a traditional friendly, she went to Mexico to distribute checks to a woman who had worked in Virginia shelling crabs. And she greeted her with the traditional mi casa es tu casa, which means my house is your house, but then added, and this floor is your floor, explaining that she was able to install the floor with the unpaid wages that Mary had helped recover. So I'm sure she has a million stories like that. I am pleased to introduce to you Mary Bauer.
Derek can take it better this way or that.
Okay. Thank you so much for that kind introduction, and I'm really thrilled to be able to be here today, because when I went to the University of Virginia School of Law, we didn't have such a conference, and it's fabulous to see all of these faces here and people interested in talking about these issues. I know that Richard is deeply sorry that he's unable to make it. He was really terribly sick. He told me, I was sharing with some people, that he told me last week when I called him and I was not feeling well, he said to me, "Wow, I don't get sick. I actually haven't been sick in 30 years. And so when he called me this week and said, "I don't think I can go to Virginia," I didn't wish that upon him, but I did think there was something of a little bit of a poetic justice in that. And he does send his deepest apologies. He loves to come to Charlottesville. He particularly loves to come to UVA, and he's real sorry to miss it. I'm going to talk today. I think my comments will be slightly different than Richard's would have been, because his kind of view is of the entire Southern Poverty Law Center, and mine is a little bit more focused. So I'm going to try to focus on kind of what I know about and talk to you all about that. Southern Poverty Law Center is a civil rights organization that was founded in 1971 in Montgomery, Alabama, as a civil rights law firm. That was the location that was the heart of the civil rights movement. And this is a photograph of the memorial center that stands outside our building, built by architect Maya Lin, and which has the names of some of the martyrs who were killed during the civil rights movement in the South. In civil rights work, I think it's fair to say that our goal is to work ourselves out of a job, to have a society that treats all with the kind of fundamental fairness and dignity. Unfortunately, in saying that, I think we can all say that our work is frankly far from done. The civil rights movement in the United States is not over. And the good news is, for those of you who have read kind of inspiring stories of those times and the things that happened and the civil rights movement of yore, the good news is that it's still possible to be a part of that. It is more than possible, I would suggest. As a lawyer, it is essential. The civil rights movement of today is broad and rich. It involves the struggle for gay and lesbian rights, rights of children, the disabled, African Americans, women, all people of color, the rights of immigrants, among others. And I think it's important to see those struggles in their context, as part of that same struggle. I represent immigrants, and the project that I work with represents immigrants. And from time to time, we're asked at the Southern Poverty Law Center, why is it that we focus on immigrants? And particularly, why do we represent undocumented workers, which, frankly, we do. We're asked a similar question about our advocacy on behalf of prisoners. And what I say to people about immigrants is, we represent immigrants because that's the best way to protect all people. We represent undocumented workers because that's the best way to protect all workers. When one group of people may be abused and exploited with impunity. That obviously degrades the working conditions, the wages, and the civil rights of everyone here in our society. I mean, for example, in the context of employment, why would an employer want to hire a U.S. citizen who demands legal treatment when there are others who would be guaranteed never to complain? And so we say that when we stand up for undocumented workers, we fight against the abuse and exploitation of all and against the erosion of civil rights generally. And there's a moral dimension to our work as well. We simply believe it is the right thing to do. Many of the industries that employ undocumented workers are known for low wages, dangerous conditions, and routine violations of the law. Just as one example, foreign-born Latino men are more than twice as likely to die on the job than U.S. citizen workers. So what is life like then for these workers who, whether we like it or not, make our lives possible? And I'd say we should make no mistake. Every one of us accepts the benefit of immigrant labor every day, whether we like that or not. We should also, I would suggest, accept the simple responsibility to make sure that people are treated fairly and lawfully. Immigrant workers are routinely subjected to abuse and exploitation because they are immigrants. Many employers target immigrants, often undocumented immigrants, in order to assure a compliant, hardworking workforce. The suffering that workers experience just to get to the job is hard for many of us to imagine. Those who enter lawfully, contracted to do a job, pay sometimes thousands of dollars simply for the right to come to the United States. Because they are poor, they don't have that kind of money, and they borrow the money, typically at very high interest rates. If they do not comply with the terms of the contract in this country, many of them risk losing their homes, or worse, in their home countries. Those who enter the U.S. illegally pay thousands of dollars to be smuggled in and risk death. They, too, arrive desperately in debt, and all of this, really, to do a job. They're in an unfamiliar country with virtually no money, thousands of miles from home. Often they don't speak the language, and they're fearful of retaliation by an employer who is also their landlord. Poor immigrants. Very reasonable fear is that the consequence of complaining is that they will be not only fired, but evicted, and possibly face deportation. My project, the Immigrant Justice Project, was created a little more than 3 years ago by the Southern Poverty Law Center in recognition of the changing demographics in the South. And what SPLC said in creating this project is that to care about civil rights in the 21st century, one has to care also about the exploitation of immigrants. Unfortunately, the lack of lawyers for immigrants in many parts of the country has led some employers to conclude that they can pay whatever wages they like without ramifications. Our project has aimed to change that in 9 states in the Deep South. While we have had some successes, our project is really just beginning, and certainly our work is just beginning. The most common problem that we hear about from workers, the complaint we receive over and over again every week, is that they worked and simply were not paid at all for the work that they did. And one can imagine the kind of consequences that people experience when they have worked a week or 2 weeks or a month or more, and expected to be paid, and then they simply didn't get that money. Particularly when people are living paycheck to paycheck and have families, the consequences can be devastating. We have heard from women who have been sexually assaulted on the job, and then basically told that they can go away, that they're undocumented, they don't have any kind of recourse. I've seen clients literally deported, evicted, arrested, physically assaulted, and even threatened with death simply because they asked to be paid their legal wages. The Reverend Martin Luther King said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. As lawyers, I think we are obliged to believe that. But sometimes, and some days, it is hard to accept that. For my clients, immigrants in the Deep South, these are very difficult times. I'm going to show you just a few slides and talk a little bit about this kind of specific work that we do at the Immigrant Justice Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Our project was created to focus on the most vulnerable immigrants in the South, and those tend to be migrant farm workers from many historical regions. So this is kind of what we regard as our service area, 9 states and really hundreds of thousands of desperately poor people who are routinely abused. Of course, we are obviously unable to represent all of those workers and to do all of the cases that need to be done. But this is the challenge. And so why did we choose migrant workers and why was this the focus? Well, seasonal farm workers are the poorest laborers in the United States. They earn an average of $6,500 per year. Farm workers who migrate, who are most of the clients we see, are poorer than settled farm workers, and they earn about $5,000 a year. The most vulnerable migrant workers, such as those laboring for farm labor contractors in the Southeast, earn annual wages as low as $3,500 a year. This dire situation that by farm workers stems from their lack of economic and political power, and frankly from the kind of history of who these workers are. Because farm workers have no measurable political influence, there has been little organized opposition to the efforts of agribusiness to deny basic legal rights and legal protections to farm workers. So just a few examples. In most of the states that we serve, farm workers are not covered by workers' compensation laws. And that's regardless of their legal status. Farm workers are not entitled to overtime under federal law. On some smaller farms, farm workers are not entitled to even the federal minimum wage because of exemptions. None of the states that we're dealing with have a state minimum wage for agriculture at all. And so when the federal minimum wage doesn't apply, there's really nothing. Child labor laws are riddled with exemptions for farm workers. And though children may not work in many industries until they're 16, in agriculture they can work as young as 10. In some states, including Alabama, where I live, farm worker children are exempt from compulsory education laws and do not need to attend schools. Many state health and safety laws exclude farm workers at all. Farm workers are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act, which gives workers a right to organize and protects them when they demand better wages and working conditions. And the truth is that the few laws that do exist that protect these workers are rarely enforced. In the South, there is no doubt that this is a vestige of slavery and of the populations who have historically filled these roles. And if there was any question about that, here's a quote from a grower in North Carolina who said, "The North won the war on paper, but we Confederates actually won because we got to keep our slaves. First we had the sharecroppers, then we had the tenant farmers, and now we have the Mexicans." That's a quote that we see sort of living and breathing every day in the kind of work that we do. Here's some pictures just of the kind of housing where we see workers living. And I actually showed these pictures to my staff, and several of them said, "You know, that housing's not bad at all. That's actually pretty good housing." And I said, yeah, but this is a picture we have. So I show this to you not as really necessarily an example of this is the worst housing where workers live, but really as very kind of typical housing conditions. This is one of the first industries that we decided to focus on in the litigation that we did. This is a gentleman who came from Guatemala to the United States to do tree planting in the Southeast. Tree planting is a really a huge southern industry, though we tend to think of it kind of in the broader view as something that happens in the Northwest, but really tree planting in the modern era is a disproportionately southern industry. And disproportionately, these workers are individuals who come to the United States on H-2B visas, that are visas that permit them to work only for the employer who brought them in. And so what we see in practice is that these workers have very few options once they get to the United States because they are legally entitled only to work for the employer who petitioned for them. And so sort of the ordinary rights that workers have when they don't like the situation and they say, I'm not going to stay here, don't apply in this situation because in this case, the worker really only has the choice of going back home to Guatemala if he doesn't like the situation. And what we see in practice for workers who are coming in as guest workers, as the phrase is used, although, frankly, I wouldn't treat my own guests this way, so I'm not crazy about the term, is that these workers have paid a lot of money for these jobs, and so the practical option of returning home is not doesn't exist because people have taken enormous debts out to get these jobs and come to the United States. And so if they find that the work is not as they might like it, their real option is just to stick it out and put up with it. So this is an industry in which workers are expected to plant 2,000 pine trees a day as a minimum. And the way they do that is to carry these small seedlings on their back in packets of hundreds, to have a tool that's kind of like a shovel, it's called a hodad or a dibble bar, to take it over their heads, strike it on the ground, create a 12-inch hole in the hard earth, put the tree in, cover it with earth and pat it down. And they are to do that at least 2,000 times a day. It is grueling work. Many workers that I've talked to have done, you know, every kind of agriculture say that tree planting is the hardest work that they've ever done physically. And we focused on that, have brought a series of class action lawsuits on behalf of workers in this industry because it is an industry in which workers are systematically exploited and have their legal rights violated. These workers are required to be paid what is called a prevailing wage rate. That's a wage rate set by the U.S. government, which is usually higher than the minimum wage. And so here's an example just of, this is one of our clients' pay stubs. It says, I'm not sure how easy that is to read back there, but it says tree planting. He planted 9,900 trees in that week, and so he earned $247.50, which represented 27 hours of work. And that's not bad. That's close. That was actually the prevailing wage rate. We did that, and we looked at the pay stub, and he said, you know, is this right? And, you know, we did the math, and it came out to the correct legal wage. But then we started to ask him, as we do to all of our clients, well, when did you start work in the morning? And when did you finish work in the morning? And how many days a week did you work? And what we discovered was that this client, as most of these clients, was working really more like 60, 70, even 80 hours in a work week. And so what we see is that he earned $247.50, but what he should have earned is $589.40, which is a difference of $341.90 in that 1 week of work. This worker was here on an 8-month contract. So obviously we're talking about really tens of thousands of dollars out of which he was cheated. And that's really what we see kind of across the board. More disturbingly, perhaps, than that kind of systematic wage abuse is what the pay stub does not reflect and what you can't see in just looking at that. He paid $2,000 to get that job. He didn't have $2,000. He was a poor farm worker in Guatemala, and so he borrowed it at very high interest rates from a loan shark. The pay stub does not reflect that he was required to give the lender the deed to his home as a condition of getting the job. And that is very typical for the workers that they see, that they are required to leave some sort of collateral, typically the deed to a home, with somebody in their home country in order to ensure that they will be compliant workers in the United States and will complete their contracts. And that, this just says immigration harassments and death threats, but what happened is that after our client was the lead plaintiff in the case, 7 thugs showed up at his home in Guatemala and told his wife that they were looking for him and that he might be killed if he was found in the United States. So that's sort of the culture of what we are seeing. In terms of the challenges that we faced as an organization, our mission is to look beyond farm workers and to look just at immigrants generally. And while most farm workers in the South are immigrants, many immigrants do reside in the South who are not farm workers. Immigrants in the South are disproportionately poor, and their numbers are growing at faster rates than other parts of the country. In some places, the census from 1990 to 2000 in some parts of the country reflected more than 1,000 percentage rate change in those 10 years. And this growth is taking place in an area of the country which is arguably the least well prepared to deal with this kind of systemic change. And this is just a map that shows you the kind of most recent census figures for immigrants in the South. We suggest that the census figures very dramatically undercount the number of immigrants, obviously, as immigrants are particularly fearful of being candid with government officials in this process. And so even by that, the numbers are very high. In Georgia and North Carolina in particular, the population is growing very dramatically. And what we see in the media, frankly, is that immigrants are being scapegoated for economic problems around the country, while the research shows that on balance, the role that immigrants play in the economy is largely positive. Millions of immigrants, documented and undocumented, are in the U.S. workforce and are contributing to the economy. Nearly all undocumented men, far above 95%, are working, which is a dramatically higher rate than it is for U.S. citizens. These workers do work disproportionately in dangerous and low-paying occupations. The evidence is that immigrants receive less in benefits than they pay in, that they do pay taxes. The Social Security Administration, for example, has a fund of more than $420 billion of earnings paid by employees who never claimed benefits. And the understanding is that a large percentage of that is paid by undocumented immigrants. And contrary to stereotypes, there's no evidence that immigrants come to the United States to receive welfare, to commit crimes. Immigrants actually use welfare at lower rates than native-born Americans. This is just not a niche issue anymore. What we see is that undocumented immigrants themselves constitute more than 5% of the United States workforce. That's a tremendous percentage, particularly when that doesn't even include the documented immigrants. And so we have tried to focus our efforts on looking at the integration of immigrants into the South and the kind of issues that are raised by the influx of large numbers of people in new areas. Where we've seen that kind of as a microcosm is in the Gulf Coast after Katrina, and really a very dramatic kind of display of some of the issues that are raised by a very large influx of population. Immediately after Katrina, we did outreach in New Orleans in particular and other parts of the Gulf Coast, and what we saw was influx of tens of thousands of immigrants who had been recruited from all over the country and outside the country to do really terribly grueling, filthy work, particularly immediately after the Reconstruction. These are some workers cleaning up toxic sludge, essentially, after Katrina. We've been involved in several large-scale lawsuits on behalf of immigrant workers, and actually that included non-immigrant workers as well, because immigrants certainly have not been the only ones who've been exploited in the Gulf Coast. But there certainly have been employers who have targeted immigrants as a population who's likely to put up with bad conditions on the job. This is a case that we brought against Belfour USA, which employed actually none of our clients directly, but employed them through a series of many subcontractors to work and who didn't pay them legal wages, essentially. The subcontractors did not pay them legal wages. We reached a settlement with Belfour in which Belfour agreed to compensate all the members of our class, and they've paid close to $1 million now, and they've agreed to monitor the behavior of their subcontractors, which is what we really wanted kind of all along, because obviously the company at the top is the company that's in the best position to change the practices of the subcontractors that work for it. We see challenges, though, in areas beyond just the workplace. Frankly, we see challenges in all areas of life in the South for new immigrants. We see workers who are harassed by immigration officials, harassed by the police. These are some pictures from a lawsuit that we are involved in against ICE, which is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in which they conducted a series of raids in South Georgia. The ICE came in and did a factory raid of a poultry plant in South Georgia, and then after they had raided the company, went door to door in the Latino community in South Georgia and you know, busted into some people's houses, and that's a door that's been busted down. The ICE's story to us was that these were voluntary conversations in which people had the right to decline to be interviewed, but the hole in the floor through which the officials came and the broken door kind of belie that argument, in our opinion. Our first named plaintiff in that lawsuit is a 16-year-old girl who is a Mexican-American, but who was born in the United States, has never been to Mexico, and has the most charming Southern accent that you've ever heard. And she was in her house one morning when about seven immigration officials busted in and screamed, "Oh, look, we found Mexicans, we found illegals." She was sort of scared out of her mind when everyone in her family was a United States citizen and had been in the United States for generations. So times are tough for immigrants in many parts of the country and in the South. This is a client that we represented, Felipa Barrera, who in 2005 lost custody of her daughter and was told that she would not regain custody until she had learned English. And that was one of the sort of main pieces of evidence against her, though, of course, her child was at that time also not an English speaker. The judge ordered that the best way for her to have a good relationship with her child was to learn English, and gave her 4 months to learn English, or he would begin termination rights against her. And so we intervened to participate and to represent her in that. And we're happy to say that her parental rights were not, in fact, terminated, and her daughter is back with her family. Over the past few years, it has been hard, frankly, to have a civil debate about immigration policy, and we're certainly not suggesting at the Southern Poverty Law Center that people can't disagree about what is the appropriate level of immigration. But what we see is that there are a lot of demagogues out there who have really monopolized the debate and who have made a real dialogue impossible. Lou Dobbs, for example, who is on CNN and is perceived as quite mainstream, has repeatedly invited members of known hate groups onto his show to vilify immigrants. The Southern Poverty Law Center, in terms of the kind of broader work we do, is perhaps best known for the work we do involving hate groups, both in the courts and in the press, and monitoring those hate groups. Here's a map of the hate groups in the United States. Between 2000 and 2006, the Southern Poverty Law Center documented an increase of about 40% in these groups, and most of that is attributable to the rising tide of anti-immigrant sentiment. And it is not just these hate groups that are fanning the flames. Here's Lou Dobbs with his show, and he really does give the country a dose of anti-immigrant rhetoric every day. And frankly, there are a lot of people who love him for it, who we would not necessarily want to be associated with. Here's a neo-Nazi website that says, calls for Lou Dobbs for president. And I'm not suggesting that Lou Dobbs can help who admires him, but I am suggesting that when Nazis are posting messages on their website saying you should be president, then you might want to examine what it is that you're saying. The problem with Dobbs is not that he opposes illegal immigration. It's that, among other things, he has made up facts to prove his case. This is really a project that Richard has been focused on and sort of wanted to talk to you about, but he really confronted Dobbs with some of the specious statements that he's made on 60 Minutes, where Dobbs had said in sort of talking about immigrants that there had been 7,000 cases of leprosy over the last several years, and that that was all attributable to illegal immigration. Well, the fact is that that just turned out to be wrong. That was just flat out wrong. There had been 7,000 cases of leprosy in the United States over 30 years, and there is absolutely no information to suggest that it is largely or even in any way attributable to immigrants. And in fact, cases of leprosy in the United States are declining. And there's just kind of the data on the cases of leprosy. So we have, you may say, well, this is a funny little anecdote, but an at SPLC, we went to Dobbs and we went to his producers at CNN and we said, you know, come on, this is really vilifying immigrants in an inappropriate way. This is wrong. We've had an open letter to Lou Dobbs asking him to retract the statement, and he refused. And he has repeatedly refused to retract any of these kinds of statements. And here's a picture of Richard Cohen right next to Lou Dobbs in the middle there, and Mark Potok, who's the director of our intelligence project at SPLC, who went on his show to confront him, and even then he declined to retract his statement. Finally, we went to the ultimate source to ask for kind of a correction of the record, and these are some of the fabulous Lou Dobbs fan mail that we received by SPLC. We do get some pretty interesting fan mail. I do like the "you can shove tolerance as far up your ass as possible. Hate is alive and growing. Have a nice day." That does reflect some of the tenor of the comments that we get. And here is the kind of ultimate source for... can you all hear that? Well, I have to say, I do, you know, sort of enjoy watching that, but the truth is that Dobbs and his kind are inspiring an increase in hate crimes against Latinos in this country and against immigrants in this country. There's a reality and there is rhetoric, and it is clear that the rhetoric has consequences. The part of our mission in the work that we do is to change the terms of the debate, and that's obviously sort of part of what we did in pitching that to the Colbert Show and in talking to the New York Times. But we've really tried to change the terms of the debate generally and to say, you know, we can have a civil debate about what is the appropriate level of immigration, but it is not appropriate to vilify immigrants and to really call for kind of the hostility and physical violence that people experience. It is clear that it is not only undocumented immigrants who pay the price for that. And recent studies have shown that Latinos, including U.S. citizen Latinos, really do feel threatened and uncomfortable by this rhetoric, and they have paid the price, really, for this kind of rhetoric. So what we have done in terms of moving, you know, the public debate further is we have tried to issue, we issued a major report on the issue of guest workers as one example to really kind of talk about, you know, we hear in the news about, well, maybe we should have guest worker programs, and what we have said is, well, we actually know a lot about guest worker programs, and before we try to, you know, decide that the solution to the immigration problem is guest worker programs, let's look at what they look like in practice. And what we've said, in practice, in the real world, they're very abusive and exploitative. So this was a report that we issued last year on the condition of immigrants in the country, and with a focus on guest workers, which we called Close to Slavery. And what we said in calling it that, frankly, is that guest worker programs are not slavery. We certainly don't mean to minimize the horrors of the slave trade and slavery in the United States. But that in practice, if you look at these programs, they're much closer to slavery or to indentured servitude than most of us would be comfortable with, and so that we should take a real good look up close. Several, this is a quote from the New York Times, stunning new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center when they wrote about our report. Several of the lawyers in our program have been called to testify before congressional committees. This is a hearing on the condition of workers in the Gulf Coast after Katrina, and that's J.J. Rosenbaum, who's a lawyer from our office. And so we've, you know, sort of tried to provide information and tried to call for a discussion about these issues that's based on both real facts, compassion, and the kind of notion of justice and fairness that we all cleave to, I think. I'm not a religious person particularly, but living in the Deep South, one learns that you should quote the Bible a lot when you're making a point, as often as possible. And so my quote for the day is from Leviticus. And the quote is, "If a stranger shall sojourn with thee in your land, you shall not oppress him. But the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be to you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." As this ancient quote instructs us, it's morally wrong to turn people away based on their immigration status, and particularly to have a legal system that does that. And our current legal system often does just that. Congress has said, for example, that undocumented workers and many legal workers are not eligible for federally funded legal services. These rules have consequences for people's lives. The rhetoric has consequences for people's lives, too. And there is a backlash from physical assaults on day laborers to many, many anti-immigrant legislative proposals in states, including Virginia, and localities throughout the country. In many states, immigration police officers are trying to and successfully enforcing the immigration code, leaving workers fearful of turning to the police when they themselves are victims of crime. What we see here, I would suggest, is, in general, a kind of criminalization of immigrants. In this new regime, immigrants equal terrorists. And even though we have kind of reached that conclusion, we rely every day on the labor of these so-called terrorists to make our lives possible. I don't want to talk only about abuse, and I do want to end with something a little hopeful, because I do think there is hope. Over and over in the work that I do, I've had the opportunity to watch men and women who have a lot to lose stand up with dignity and fight for their rights. I think that my clients have been and are really extraordinary people. I've listened to stories of hundreds, probably thousands of workers over the course of my career. I've defended hundreds of clients who have sat through depositions to tell their stories, often at great personal risk. In doing so, I have been struck listening to workers by how many of them have the same answer to the one question that is inevitably asked as they sit through depositions. And that question is, what do you hope to get out of this lawsuit? And virtually all of the workers who have responded to that have said, and all of the clients that I have had have said, well, I hope to get justice for the other workers so that no one else gets treated the way that I was treated. It is truly an honor to represent people who believe so deeply in the notion of justice for all. From time to time, I have been asked a question. Why is it that I sort of choose to sacrifice myself to do this kind of work? Now I know, and I think many of you here know, that this is a flawed question, that it is not a sacrifice to do work that provides one's life meaning. It is not a sacrifice to do work that one that gives life purpose and that allows you to represent people for whom you have the deepest of respect. I look around at friends from my law school class who are doing other kinds of work, and they don't seem happier to me. They certainly don't seem happier in their work. They certainly seem that many of them are not completely fulfilled and satisfied with their work. And frankly, I feel lucky. I look at my clients who perform grueling and dangerous work with little pay, and I know that I am lucky. As you saw, the average wages of a family of four who work as farm workers is about $6,500. And so I say, even on the legal aid salary plan that I was on for many years, I am lucky and I have been honored. It is truly a joy to do the work that I do. Low-wage immigrant workers do not have political advocates. And by definition, they themselves cannot vote. And so I would suggest that in this context, the decision to stand up for your rights is an extraordinary and selfless act. My clients have not gotten rich from the cases they've been involved in. Because of the kinds of cases that we do, typically they are entitled to little more than the wages they were due in the first place. But they have stood up for something more important than money, the right to be taken seriously as a human being and to be treated with dignity. And so I want to leave you with just one final word of advice and an admonition. And this may seem counterintuitive when I say this, but you should not, I would suggest, think of others when you decide what work you will do. You should not be called to public service out of a sense of sacrifice and duty. Instead, you should think of yourself. You should think of a career and choose it because it is good for you, and it is good on every level. Choose it because it will give your life meaning, it will make you happy, it will make you a better person. We spend, certainly in our office, we spend far too much time at the office, far too many hours of the day at the office, and it's too much time out of one's life and from the other commitments that we have with family and children and all of that to settle for something as unimportant in the world as money. I would suggest that you should aim for something higher than that and don't settle for just that. You can choose to be a part of the great march toward justice, as slow and imperfect as it is. And I hope and wish that you choose that for yourself. Thank you.